Welcome to Books and Beyond, where each week at this time we explore books, authors, and much more. Here's your host, Bonnie Bloss.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to another edition of Books and Beyond. Tonight, our guest is Diane Zekman. She grew up on a South Dakota farm and attended a one-room country school. After graduating from Clear Lake High School, she received her BA in elementary education, English, and Spanish from Augustana College in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Now a retired U.S. Navy captain, she has added being an author to the many things she's done in her life. Diane always dreamed of becoming a teacher, but she changed her mind when one-room schools were mandated for closure. Instead, she enlisted in the Navy, working as an aviation storekeeper for 2 years before attending officer candidate school. She earned her commission in 1975. Diane was designated an aeronautical maintenance duty officer in 1979 and was promoted to captain in 1997. She commanded a defense contract management agency before working in her final naval assignment in the office of the Naval Inspector General in Washington, D.C. Diane is the author of Live Fast, Love Hard, The Fair and Young Story, Navy Green Shirt, A Leader Made, Not Born, A Farm in the Hidewood, My South Dakota Home, and her latest book is 20th Century Drifter, The Life of Marty Robbins, published in 2012. For 5 years, she wrote a newspaper column of military and travel experiences. She is listed in Marquis's Who's Who of American Women, 1997 to 1998, 2000 to 2001, and 2002 to 2003. Diane graduated from the Naval War College and holds master's degrees from Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Aeronautical Science and Business Administration in Aviation. She's an avid runner, has participated in more than a dozen marathons and ultrathons, and in her spare time, she loves dancing, country and western music, reading, and has a Mary Kay beauty consultant business. She has two daughters, April and Amanda. Welcome, Diane.
Welcome, Bonnie.
My goodness, there's a lot to know about you.
Well, I've been around for a few years.
So have we all. Why did you choose to write about Farron Young and Marty Robbins in particular?
I wrote about Farron Young because after he committed suicide, it seemed like he was being forgotten. Often when a list of singers were mentioned and I knew he belonged in that category, he wasn't there. And I also wanted to write books as a retirement career because I couldn't stay in the Navy forever. And I thought how great it would be to write the biography of Farron Young, who was one of my favorite singers, and meet all these country singers I had grown up listening to, and all the ones who knew Farron would have stories to tell about him. So I just started chipping away, started making phone calls, started traveling, and I eventually met enough people and did enough interviews to have the information that I could put a book together.
Was there anyone you got in touch with that surprised you, who was willing to talk to you, you thought might not be?
Well, a lot of them at the beginning. The one that sticks most in my mind was Daryl McCall, who was one of Farron's band members, and then he's someone that I have heard of over the years because he's had a singing career. So I thought when I called him, why would this person who was a famous singer want to talk to me? But he did. He was just as friendly as could be. And so was everybody else I talked to. I mean, I've been out to Jeannie Seeley's house. I've visited with Bill Anderson, and I've been to Jan Howard's house. I've met a lot of people, and they were just also friendly, and many of them said, oh yeah, Farron's story needs to be told, and I guess they trusted me to do it, so it worked out really well.
As you wrote about both of them, especially in Farron's case, how did your view change considering what a negative and in many ways troubled life Farron led?
That was the thing that I really had to work at to find the balance, to know there was the negativity and to address it and still come out with a positive image, because you have to, I mean, I do anyway, I have to like the person I'm writing about. And he did have so much good stuff, so I put enough in there to show the bad side. But what I discovered was the explanation for it, the fact that he suffered from depression his whole life. And when I read up on depression, I found out that his behavior was just classic for the way a man acts who suffers from depression. He can't admit he has this problem. He has to hide it. So he gets violent and a daredevil. And Farron, of course, had the alcoholism, and people react to that differently. And he was a mean drunk, an abusive drunk. And he just had two very different sides. So I balanced both of them, but there were people who knew his bad side and loved him anyway. So he had to be a really neat person. There was something about him that people wanted to be around him anyway, even though they knew how he might act.
Your brother had a dream about you writing the book that you took as a sign. Tell us about that.
Oh, I'd forgotten about that. Yes, he did. He told me he was on a cruise ship someplace, and he had this dream that Farron was there too, and they had chatted, and Ronnie said something about, well, yeah, my sister is writing your biography, and Farron says, I know that. And when Ron told me that, I took it as Farron was sending his approval. He was saying it was okay. And the sign that was in there is what Ron remembered was that Farron was wearing a blue suit. And I told Ron that was Farron's favorite color. And Ron had never met Farron, but he had this dream where Farron appeared in this blue suit, which was his favorite color, and he let Ronnie know that he knew I was writing his biography. So that really encouraged me.
Farron's sister, I believe it was Dorothy, asked one thing of you, and that was that you write about him with kindness. Did she approve of what you had written?
I can't remember exactly when she died. I don't think she lived long enough to ever read what I had written. I can't remember the exact year that she died, but I think it was before the book was published.
What was the rest of the family's reaction, his wife and children?
They have all been supportive. I mean, they could tell that I wasn't digging up the dirt, and I didn't really have to get it from them because there's enough of it out there. And I did manage to get my hands on the divorce transcript of their divorce trial, and there was enough acrimony in that that I could pretty well piece together the bad things that happened in the family, that I didn't have to go ask Hilda and Alana and Robin and Damien about those things, because I got enough that I could put in the book to get the point across. So when we talked, it was more the pleasant memories, and they were pleased with the outcome of the book. And Robin in particular told me that he really appreciated what I had written about Farron's girlfriend back when he was a teenager, because it showed that Farron had always been like this. It's nothing the family had done to make him act like that. It's just the way he was. And of course, you know, any family with an abuser, an alcoholic in it, the family members always wonder, what did I do wrong? And of course, the person like Farron, he used to accuse them, well, I wouldn't act like this if you didn't act like that, sort of thing. But it showed them that they got a better understanding of Farron because they found out this is who he really was, and it didn't have anything to do with them.
I think your book probably filled in many gaps for them. You probably did.
Yes,
them a great service.
It did. And that was one of the things that Robin told me, that it gave them a much better understanding of who he was. It makes it more of a sad story, too, that you can understand the trials and tribulations that somebody like this goes through when they're dealing with these issues and have nowhere to turn.
Farron and Marty both grew up in houses with alcoholic fathers. What influence do you think this had on their careers and in the way they related to their wives and children? Were they different in how they did that?
They reacted differently, yeah. Farron's dad wasn't an alcoholic, but he was cold. He was more verbally abusive or just cold. There was no love there. There was no father-son love. Neither one of them had that. So they both grew up wanting to have their dad approve of them and knowing they could never get that. You know, they could never be good enough for their fathers. So that was a struggle that they always had, I think. It's one of these childhood things you carry over. And they both craved attention and approval. And the difference that I saw in them is Farron just wanted attention, and he didn't really care. I mean, bad attention was better than no attention at all. So he didn't really care if it was, I mean, he did, but if it was negative or positive attention, he just wanted attention. Marty, it had to be favorable. Marty needed approval. So he wanted attention too, and he became a comedian so that people would enjoy being around him and that sort of thing. And that's how Marty was extremely shy, and he overcame his shyness by becoming this outgoing personality. But he was always seeking approval. But for Marty, it had to be positive. Farron, he just wanted attention.
Were there similarities other than what we've mentioned between the two of them?
Yes, there were. Well, from similar backgrounds starting out, they both grew up not having any money, and they moved around a lot. Farron's family moved to a few different places in Shreveport, but Farron's dad was always employed. He always supported his family, whereas Marty's dad did not, and they often lived in tents and shacks because they had no real home. They lived out on the desert. But both of them, once they became entertainers and famous singers and such, they both credited their audiences and were very appreciative of their audiences. They acknowledged that, I wouldn't be up here if all these people weren't out there spending their hard-earned dollars to buy my records and come to my shows. So when I do a show, I'm going to entertain them, and I want them to know that I appreciate them. And both Farron and Marty had well-rounded, complete shows. They both dressed their bands well, and they both had the interaction, the telling jokes, all this sort of stuff. And to me, since I saw both of them on stage, to me it went overboard. I wanted them just to sing the songs, but they enjoyed the clowning around and the entertaining and the getting the laugh and all that. So they were quite a bit similar in their stage presence and in their desire to let their fans know they appreciated them. And they both stayed after the shows, late after the shows, to sign all the autographs.
Ken Nelson discovered Farron. Tell us a little bit about that discovery.
As part of Ken Nelson's job, he used to travel around the countryside and find new singers to sign. He was what's called an A&R man, an artist in repertoire, and he worked out of Los Angeles, Hollywood, at Capitol Records. And one day he was down in Shreveport. He'd been there for a few days, I guess, and he was leaving. He didn't drive. He always had somebody who was driving him. And they were leaving town, and he heard this singer on the radio, and it just really caught Ken's attention, but the name wasn't announced. He didn't know who it was, but it was a live program at KWKH in Shreveport, so they turned the car around, or he went there the next day, I think it was. But anyway, he turned the car around and went back, and then I think it was the next day he went to find out who it was, and somebody told him, well, that was Webb Pierce, and he said, no, I know what Webb Pierce sounds like, and it wasn't him. And he said, oh, well, that was Farron Young. And Farron didn't have a publishing contract, although it's sometimes said that he did, but he didn't. But Ken called up his friend Hubert Long, who was a manager of singers and a booking agent and such. So Hubert signed Farron to a management contract, and Ken Nelson signed him to a recording contract. And he worked with both of them for years. But at the time, Farron was 19 years old, and he wasn't legally old enough to sign a contract. So his parents had to sign it for him. And I did, in my research, get a copy of that. So it's kind of neat to look at this old contract and see Farron's parents' name signed on it as certifying that Farron is their son.
I can't do the show without asking you to tell a little bit about the date-swapping story involving Hank Williams Sr. and Farron.
Oh, okay. Well, there's a lot of different versions to that. But the best that I could come up with, it was in June of 1952 when Farron had moved to Nashville, and he brought his girlfriend with him from Shreveport, Billie Jean Jones Eshelman. She was probably still married to Eshelman at the time, or they were separated anyway. So she went with Farron, and they were friends, lovers, whatever they were, but they weren't planning on getting married. They both had their own agenda, and I guess they got what they needed from each other. But anyway, when they got to Nashville and Farron was on the Opry that night, he asked Ken Nelson to ask his girlfriend, Billie Jean, over to the Opry from the hotel where they were staying. So Ken did, and they got backstage at the Ryman, and Hank Williams was there, and he said, "Hey, Ken, who's your girlfriend?" And Ken says, "She's not my girlfriend. She's with Farron Young." And then at the end of the show, this is where there are several different stories, but the way Farron told the story, that the one that I used, was that they went over to Hank's house at some point, and Hank was showing Billy all these different guns that he had, and Farron went in another room, and Hank pointed a gun at Farron and says, "I want your girlfriend." And Farron says, "Okay, you can have her." But there was also something in there that Hank had a date that night with some gal from Philadelphia, and they swapped dates, and Hank went off with Billy Jean, and Farron got the other gal. But Farron at that point, you know, Hank Williams, he was a star. He was Farron's hero, and here's Farron, this little unknown country boy from Shreveport. So I'm sure it wasn't hard for him to say, "Yeah, Hank, you can have her."
Oh, that was a funny story. I think of Farron's career as almost existing in three parts. There was the early part where, as you said, he really admired Hank Williams Sr. so much that he really sounded like him. And I was real happy, although I like Hank Williams Sr., I was thrilled when he started to do the music that really I felt was really him. And then we had the almost the pop music type period with songs like The Locket. Why did country singers, Farron in particular, and probably to some extent Morty too, why did they feel they had to do songs that would bring in a pop audience?
Well, to make money for their career to survive. At the beginning, in the early 50s, everybody wanted to sound like Hank Williams because he was the top. He was their idol. He was the star. So all the wannabe singers sounded like Hank Williams. You know, now we have so many who want to sound like George Strait or Garth Brooks. They wanted to sound like Hank. And one of Farron's band members told him, this is when he was in the Army, and his band members told him, "Farron, we already have a Hank Williams. We need you to sound like Farron Young." And he started developing his own voice and had a bunch of hits then and up through Live Fast, Love Hard, Die Young in 1955 and several more. And then when Elvis Presley took over, it just changed the entire music industry because everybody wanted Elvis, and he had this teen crowd, and the country music industry just took a nosedive. So most of the singers recorded a bunch of stuff, the pop-sounding things, because that's where the money was. That's who was buying the records, going to the shows. So Marty did his teen era stuff, like the white sport coat and the pink carnation up through Just Got Married and She's Only 17 and all those teen sounding songs. And then Farron did the Locket and I Can't Dance and all this kind of stuff for maybe like 56, 57 in there. And then in about 58, then things started turning around again and people appreciating the real country sound. And then Farron came out with songs like Alone With You and Country Girl, and then he was then back on track to doing his country stuff.
At some point in his career, Farron decided to publish the work of songwriters rather than share credit in the writing of songs. What effects did that have?
Well, they both did that, and a lot of people did, but those two made it more of a business than some, because the money for a song goes to three people. One is the songwriter, one is the publishing company, and then one is the singer. So when the record label publishes a song, they have to pay those three different people. So like what Marty did, he wrote the songs. He owned the publishing company that he put them in, and then he sang them. So all that money came back to him. All the royalties came back to him. He didn't have to share them. And although Farron didn't write his songs, he did own several publishing companies where he would buy songs from other people. And back in those days, a lot of times, and some of those really good songwriters who didn't have any money, who for whatever reasons, whether they drank it all away or what, they would just write these songs and sell them to somebody to get a few dollars. So, and some of those songs that Farron bought and put in his publishing company, and then they would put his name or somebody else's on them who weren't really the actual writer. But that happened a lot. And then the other thing that happened a lot is that singers would insist on songwriting credit before they'd record the song. And Webb Pierce was notorious for that. If he recorded any songs, like when he recorded Mel Tillis' songs, he insisted on songwriter credit, so the song said it was written by Mel Tillis and Webb Pierce when it really wasn't. Well, that was the way Farron was trained. But up to about 1960 or so, he would want half. He'd say, I want half the song. And then after that, he never did. He was more interested in supporting other writers and helping beginners get started and that sort of thing. So he'd put their songs in his publishing company and he'd record them, but he didn't take any songwriting credit for it. So, I mean, a lot of it is about money. But for the songwriters themselves, to them, it was the name. They were willing to give up songwriting credit or half of it just so that they could have a famous singer record their song.
It's amazing how that credit for songs was done, because you could just be sitting beside someone on a bus and have an idea or throw out a line and got your songwriting credit.
Well, a lot of writers would do that. They probably didn't have to. They could have taken it, but you know, whether it was ethical or whatever, a lot of times they would share it. Like a backtrack that Alex Zanatus wrote for Farron, Farron's got partial credit on that because Farron said, write me a song called Backtrack. So Alex did, and then he gave Farron credit for coming up with the song. And sometimes people don't take credits, like Bill Anderson's song, Poor Folks, about if a wolf had ever come to our front door, he'd have had brought a picnic lunch. Roger Miller gave him that line, but Roger Miller didn't want credit for it. But technically, that song should have been listed as co-written by Bill Anderson and Roger Miller. So it is just kind of up to the writers and what they decided as to give credit or not. But technically, if somebody put a few lines in your song, you were supposed to give them credit for it.
Well, as long as they were happy with it, that's really all that really matters. But it's amazing how much there was to all of that.
Oh yeah, you know, and so much of it is just sitting around chatting, driving down the road at night, or even sitting in a bar and overhearing a line. I've heard many stories about how you'd hear one person in the bar say something to his wife or the person next to him, and somebody would overhear that line and said, that's a great line for a song, and then they would write a song just based on that line. You know, those people obviously didn't get credit. They didn't even know who it was who said it.
Well, I guess that just goes to show that you may hear something profound just about anywhere.
You certainly can, yes.
I was amazed and intrigued with the story of the concert in West Virginia that led to the lawsuit about the little girl. Tell that story.
Oh, yes.
That's quite a
story. And that's one of the things where it's all the negative publicity wins. But that particular show, and I have talked to several of the people that were there, the band members and audience members also, that they said there was this little girl who was running around, and she had white coveralls or something on, but rolling around on the floor, and her clothes were all dirty, and she went over and she took things out of people's purses in the front row, and she was always making noise and spitting up to the stage, and Farron asked her parents to come get her, and nobody would, and he told her to behave herself, and she wouldn't, and so to try to stop the disruption, he called her up on stage to help him sing a song, which was his tradition. Whenever he sang This Little Girl of Mine, he always called a little girl up on stage to sing with him, and then he'd give her a $5 bill or something for helping him. So he picked up this little girl and brought her up on stage to sing with him, but she wouldn't, and you know, he thought that would settle her down, but she wouldn't. She just pulled his hair and grabbed the microphone and dropped it on the floor. So He turned her over and popped her a couple times on her butt and set her on the floor. And then after that, then her dad came and got her. And then they pressed charges against Farron that very night for child abuse or assault or whatever it was. And there are many people who think that the whole thing was a setup, that the guy bruised his daughter himself, and he didn't take her in to be examined until the next day and showed the authorities that there were bruises on her. And the people at the show insisted that there's no way Farron could have caused any bruises by the way he handled her. But people think that the family just, here's a way that they can sue a famous singer and get some money out of him. But of course, the media got it, so it was in all the news reports. And it drug on for quite a while before the court case finally got settled. And the only reports really that got in the paper were the ones of the dad telling his story. The ones of anybody else who was there, the other eyewitnesses, you know. Because there were even people who went around and took statements from people saying that, you know, this is what happened. It wasn't that way. But anyway, Farron finally settled that. He just paid them some money just to get it closed. And they had just finished that one when he was in Tulsa for a concert. And pretty much the same thing happened there. Somebody set up this gal to report Farron for dropping his pants in front of her when actually he had been in his dressing room and he needed to change clothes to get out on stage. Then he told everybody he needed to change his clothes, and some people hung around anyway. And then later, this woman who had stayed in his dressing room, somebody put her up to saying, well, he exposed himself to her. And of course, that was in all the papers. And that went on for more than a year. And there were warrants out. He couldn't go to Oklahoma until it was settled and all that. And it was a big fiasco. And in the research I did on that one, it appeared to me that the assistant district attorney or whoever in Tulsa, he thought he could make a name for himself because he could show that he got this famous singer and he convicted him, and that was his goal, and it didn't turn out that way. But of course, when that was settled, there was nothing in the paper explaining the other side on that either. It just kind of went away.
It just goes to show how even if your life was really together and you were living well, how easily things can be derailed.
Oh, they certainly can. And if somebody wants to do it to you, then you have to defend yourself. And yeah, there's been a lot of people who've spent their life savings defending themselves against something they didn't do.
Marty had some problems with the law as a teenager. What did he get involved with?
Marty was a bit of a delinquent. You know, he had no dad, so to speak. And his parents got divorced when he was about 13. So he was just a wild child just running around town. And they didn't have any money. So he would rig up pinball machines and pay phones so that they could get the money out of them. And just different teenage mischief. And he also said he got in a lot of fights and beat people up. So he was just the typical bored teenager with nothing more to do with his time than get in trouble and without parental supervision. And then he dropped out of high school and his mom finally let him drop out and join the Navy. And then things got a little better for him after that. But it was just the troublesome teenage years is what he went through. But he's never been forgiven for that because Glendale, Arizona is his hometown. He still is not accepted. And I can't think of any other reason than somebody must still be alive who can remember the trouble he got into back in 1940.
That sounds like those stories about the little towns who build a new high school and the people there are all upset because the high school they went to no longer exists, or it becomes a junior high or whatever. They just don't have enough to do, I guess.
Well, no, I don't know, but you would think they would be proud of Marty Robbins and as famous as he is.
Oh,
and
definitely.
And all that he did in later years and all the people he helped and everything. And he'd go back home once in a while and do shows in Phoenix and stuff and visited his mom while she was still alive. But after Marty died, he's not received much recognition there.
That's sad. We know that Webb Pierce was really very much Theron's mentor. Who was behind Morty Robbins?
Well, it would have been Frankie Starr while he lived in Phoenix, and he worked in Frankie's band, and they traveled together, and Marty learned a lot from him, and they went to Los Angeles together. Once Marty got his contract, Jimmy Dickens had come through town and seen him, and then he reported him to Columbia Records, and they came out, signed him to a contract. He was that good. But about that time, when he was doing all his nightclub work, it was mostly with Frankie Starr that he did it. And then also, he had a TV show there, and Harry Stone, who used to manage WSM Radio in Nashville, was managing the radio station in Phoenix. So he knew little Jimmy Dickens, and he also was the one who was responsible for Marty's first Opry appearance. So he did have those kind of contacts. But as for actually a mentor and somebody to work with, for a while there, it was Frankie Starr. But most of the time after that, Marty was pretty much just on his own, and he had band members would give him advice and help him improve and stuff like that. But Marty was just such a strong character, such a perfectionist, that he had to do everything right. So he just kept working on things until he got good. A few years later, after he was in Nashville, I don't know if there was much musical influence, but concerning business and real estate, he got in with Eddie Arnold, and he learned a lot from him. And Eddie Arnold, as I'm sure you know, did a great job of business and real estate and all that in Nashville. And Marty made money working with him. So he got some of his business advice and such from Eddie Arnold. But a lot of what Marty did, he just worked at it. He had his record producers, like Farron had Ken Nelson, and he had Hubert Long to guide him and support him. Well, Marty had a good record producer in Don Law, who he worked with for 4 years. But when it came to management and that sort of thing, Marty did not. He trusted his friends who shouldn't have been trusted. So there was a lot of money went down the tubes and a lot of opportunities missed and those sort of things, just because Marty didn't have somebody strong like a Hubert Long to help him along.
Along with that question, along with what you just said, in terms of losing money and making mistakes, we all always think about the songs that singers pass on. Are there songs that both Marty and Theron passed on that they wish they hadn't, and could you name a couple of them?
Well, with Theron, it was one. It must have been after Hello Walls with Willie Nelson. There was another song, and Farron passed on it, and it became a big hit for Billy Walker. And Farron said he went out in the yard and built himself an ass-kicking machine after that because he regretted turning that song down. But as for Marty, most of his songs he did were his songs. He recorded mostly his own, or if they would come to him and it was one he liked, he would do. But I'm not aware that Marty ever missed out on a hit. He complained because other people wouldn't record his songs. He says, nobody wants a Marty Robbins song. But I've had people tell me that nobody could do a Marty Robbins song. Once Marty Robbins sang it, it had been sung. And so people didn't record his songs because they didn't think they could do them as well as he did. But Marty didn't feel that way. He just thought other people didn't want his songs.
Advertising back when they were recording was very important and was very tied to the chart in those early days. Explain how that worked.
Well, the one big thing that was important was to be a Grand Ole Opry star. That was kind of the glue that held everybody together in the country music world, whether they were members of the Opry or not. They were advertised that way. And then being on the road, they had to travel and do the shows. But the record charts have changed over the years. It used to be that there was jukebox play and there was radio play and there were record sales. And then they revised the systems. Well, then there was a cash box songs and the Billboard songs. and different things like that. So that did help. You know, back in those days, people could also just go to the radio stations and find a disc jockey who liked their song and get it played a lot. And that working up the radio play would help also. So there were different ways of doing that. But back then, a song, once it did hit the top of the charts, could stay there for a long time. Like some of Farron's Alone With You was the number one song for 13 weeks. And I know some people have had a number one song that lasted, like I think Hank Snow had one, that was number one for more than 21 weeks. You know, that's a long time. And people sometimes ask me, well, how many number one hits did Farron have? And I said, well, he had five. And that doesn't sound like very much. But when you add up the weeks, like I've compared, Roseanne Cash had 11 number one hits. And each of her songs hit number one for 1 week and then was gone.
Right.
So she had a total of 11 songs that were number one for a total of 11 weeks. Farron had one song that was number one for 13 weeks. So, you know, if you added up the weeks a song is at number one, it certainly would be much greater than somebody who has more number one songs and they only go up there and fall back down again. But that's one of the ways that the music industry has changed over the years. But as for advertising, I don't know. I mean, they used to take out ads all the time and say the song's climbing up the charts and all that sort of thing. And I don't think there's the emphasis anymore on chart play on songs, but that may be part of the reason that they just don't stay there like they used to.
One of the things that Marty did very well and was very knowledgeable about was in understanding where to go to have certain songs recorded, which I thought was a phenomenal thing that he did. Explain that.
Well, he was confident enough in himself that he stuck up for what he wanted. And in the early stages of his career, he went to Dallas. Well, actually, his first recording session was in Los Angeles at the Columbia Studios there. And they had given him a list of songs that he was supposed to learn. And when he got there for the recording session, he was asked, had he learned these songs? And he said, well, no, he didn't really like them. He liked his own better. And that's pretty gutsy for somebody who is at his first recording session with a newly signed contract to say, I want to do my own songs. But they eventually let him. And I think part of the problem there, you know, it goes back to the songwriter credit thing, that the songs they wanted him to learn, whoever the session leader was, either had songwriting credit or publishing credit, so he knew if Marty had a hit, he would get some money off it. Well, if Marty recorded his own songs, then they would lose that. But they did eventually let him record his own songs. And then he did record some in Nashville. They had a recording studio, the Castle Recording Studio, and some of the guys got started there. And then they would also go to Dallas to the Jim Beck studio out there, and Marty went out there for four or five sessions to record his songs there in Dallas. And then it was after that when Music Row got started and Columbia Records built their new studio on 16th Avenue, and then the whole music business went to Music Row after that. But before that, it had been kind of scattered around. But the reason Marty ended up in New York City was because after he had recorded Singing the Blues and his record company had recorded the same song with Guy Mitchell up in New York City and put strings and everything on it, and it sold. It was a pop song then, and it sold so many more than Marty's country song did. And then they did it twice with his next song also. They had Guy Mitchell cover the songs of somebody on their own label, and because it was a pop song as opposed to country, it outsold it. So he had the song he wrote, A White Sport Coat and a Pink Carnation, and he took it to New York City, and he had it recorded in the studio where I think it's the same studio that Guy Mitchell had recorded his songs. So Marty went to where the recording could be done and done by the experts. So it was Mitch Miller and Ray Conniff who did Marty's sessions. So, you know, he had the top of the line there doing his recordings. And that, of course, was a big hit. So for the next couple of years, he went up to New York City and recorded there most of those teen kind of songs he did there. But he had this real hankering to do a Western album because his greatest love was Western music. And those Ray Conniff and Mitch Miller up in New York City weren't about to record any Western songs. So Marty finally convinced his producer in Nashville, Don Law, to let him record an album of Western songs. And that was when he recorded El Paso and the Gunfighter Ballads, which 50 years later is still a popular album. So, I mean, he really made his mark with that one. And he knew that's what he wanted to do, and he kept at it until he got it, and it's one of the classics.
Marty eventually got interested in NASCAR racing and actually drove. Tell us about some of the mishaps he was involved in and how he got interested in that.
Well, Marty was always interested in racing. Back in Phoenix, when he still lived there, he used to go to the races, but he didn't have any money, so he couldn't afford to have a car or anything like that. And then when he moved to Nashville, he got started in the micro midgets, and then he moved up to a next category, and as he made more money, then he could afford these cars. And then he drove out at the Fairground Speedway in Nashville for many years, mostly all through the 60s, driving stock cars there. And they had a NASCAR race in like 68, and Marty drove in that, and he drove somebody else's car. And then he got his own car, and it's really unusual for someone who's not a professional race car driver, for somebody who only does it once in a while, to be able to compete with the professionals. And Marty did. He was that good. He didn't plan to win, so maybe that was part of it. He didn't have the stress of the others because he wasn't trying to win. He was just out there to have a good time. Now, he became friends with all the NASCAR guys, and one of Bobby Allison's quotes is that Marty started out as a singer who drove race cars, and he became a race car driver who could sing. It's just because he had the natural talent for that, and it was his passion. He loved racing as much as he loved singing, but he knew singing was his business. That's where the money came from. So he really struggled for a while there, that the racing had become more important than the singing, and he knew that was wrong because singing was his livelihood and a lot of people depended on him, so he had to focus on the singing. Although he quit several times, gave up racing because he'd wreck a car or because he had his heart attacks, he still always went back, and his last race was just a month or so before his death. Oh, you ask about the mishaps he had.
Yeah.
Well, there were several times in the big races that he got run into and his car spun and hit the wall. And there was one race where Richard Childress had spun out and Marty was coming at him, and he turned the car and smashed into the wall to avoid hitting Childress's car. So Richard Childress gives Marty credit for having saved his life. So if Marty hadn't turned that car out, we might never have had a Dale Earnhardt, because Richard Childress was his car owner. There were several occasions like that. And then Marty would get upset when somebody would ask him about, like when Ralph Emery would ask him about how many cars he wrecked or how many times he hit the wall. And he'd say, why do you have to ask me those questions? You know, why can't you talk about the things that go well?
You know, we've concentrated a lot on the negative stuff about Farron in this interview, and I didn't really mean to do that. He was certainly a very cool person in many ways, but he was also a very generous person. Tell us about some of the positive things he did
okay.
for people.
Well, he definitely was generous. He always apparently had a roll of $100 bills with him, but he would do various things. Like, he noticed somebody once, some gal who came to one of his shows, and her teeth stuck out or something. And he told her, you'd be a beautiful girl if you just fix your teeth. And, you know, of course, she was absolutely crushed and humiliated. But he gave the money to his band members to give her to go get her teeth fixed. And there were different cases like that. And one of the band members told me about when he had back surgery, and he said he would have lost everything because of the health problems, but Farron gave him some money to tide him over, and then he went to the Opry Musicians Fund to get some money to help pay his hospital bill and things like that. But quite a few of the band members told me stories about how when they needed money, Farron would just peel off some $100 bills, and then they'd try to pay it back, and he would brush it off. But he often just gave money away to complete strangers because he thought they needed something.
There was a great story about the bull.
Oh, yeah, that was Willie Nelson. And that goes back to when Willie Nelson had written Hello Walls. And Farron also was well known for helping up-and-coming songwriters. And like, he gave Willie Nelson money to buy groceries, and he put their songs in his record company and all these sorts of things to help him out. So Willie wanted to sell him that song, and Farron said, no, this is going to be a hit. You need to keep songwriter credit for it. And he says, I'll just lend you some money. So he gave Willie $500 or whatever. And then he recorded Hello Walls, but he did not take ownership of the song. So when the song became a big hit, or even before it became a big hit, at some point Farron said to Willie, well, no, you just take this money and then someday you fatten up a calf for me. Because Willie apparently had a ranch with some cattle, and he said, and that'll make us even. So many years later, Willie's son bought this purebred Simmental bull at a charity auction. So Willie called Farron and told him he was delivering his bull, and Farron didn't know what he was supposed to do. You know, he thought it was a calf. So he talked to Jimmy C. Newman, and Jimmy said, well, yeah, I got a ranch. You can bring it out here. So Farron said, okay. So when they pull up, it's not a calf. It's this huge Simmental purebred bull. So they brought it out to Jimmy C. Newman's farm, and he kept it there and for, I guess, the rest of its life or something. And then Farron gave him half ownership of it because he took care of it. But that was how Willie repaid the, I'll fatten the calf for you someday. He gave him this big bull. And the funny thing about that, what I uncovered when I was doing the research about Farron's divorce trial, and they divided up all their property, the bull was listed as a marital asset, and Farron's lawyer objected, and he said, Hilda doesn't own half that bull. That was something way back then for me. And they said, no, because it was a result of his musical earnings and all of that. Those are marital assets. So when Farron had to pay Hilda for his half of the stuff that belonged to her, he had to pay her several thousand dollars for that bull that Willie had given him years ago. That's one of the fun things about being a biographer. You come across all those little tidbits.
Oh, absolutely. Like the trivia about Morty being the last performer at the old Ryman and the first one to perform in the new Ryman, or their new home, actually.
That was the first night, yeah.
Yeah, that was really cool.
He closed the last show at the Ryman, and then he closed the show the first night at the new Opry House, too. Yes, he did.
Did any of their children go into the music business? I know that Marty didn't want his daughter Janet to, but are any of them in the business now?
Ronnie Robbins sings once in a while, and he can sound like Marty. Last year when we went to Nashville for the book release party for 20th Century Drifter, Ronnie came there, and he sang El Paso, and Joe Babcock and Jim Glazer sang Harmony, and they said they hadn't sung together Harmony on that song in 50 years since they used to be in Marty's band. But Ronnie is a good singer, and he just has chosen not to make it his business. Although back in the 70s, he did try a singing career, and Marty had a record contract for him, but he called him Marty Robbins Jr. instead of letting him go by his real name, and it didn't take off. And then he did stuff as Ronnie Robbins. So he still sings once in a while, more like on reunion shows and stuff like that. He certainly can do it. And Janet plays the piano, and I think she performs, but not in the country venues or anything like that. But she is a good musician. And then on Farron's Family, Robin sings, and he had a singing career back in the 70s for a while, too, and he's getting back into music. Off and on over the years, he's been singing at various shows and things like that, too, but he recently has done some recording, and he's got some songs on the independent charts now, so, yeah, Robin Young is rejuvenating his career right now, but the others don't perform.
Well, in the few minutes we have left, I want to give people here a chance to ask you some questions. There's so much to cover. My goodness, I could do another hour with you so easily, and maybe we will sometime, about your life, because it's as fascinating as theirs is for sure. But for now, I want to give other people a chance to ask you some questions.
Hi, Dave. My name is Joshua, and I just wanted to say I really enjoyed the Farron Young book. It was a great book. There's a lot I didn't know about Farron Young until I read it, and I just wanted to say what a good job of it, and hopefully the Marty Robbins book will be available in an accessible format for the blind sometime. Hopefully it'll get on Bookshare. If it gets on Bookshare, I'm going to get it and read it definitely. I've been a Marty Robbins fan ever since I was like 6 or 7 years old, going down in my grandpa's basement listening to old records. Then Farron Young, I got the 5-disc box set, the classic years. What a great box. What a great voice Farron had, and I just wanted to thank you for writing the books, because Marty and Farron were two of the greatest, that's for sure.
I appreciate the kind words, and I haven't heard anything about Marty's book being recorded for the blind, so I don't know. I hope that will happen, but I'm glad you enjoyed Farron's story.
Next question or comment for Diane?
Hello, everybody. This is Gary Wood from Lansing, Michigan. How long ago, I missed part of this, but how long ago was it that Farron Young passed away?
1996.
Too bad that a talent like his left us way too soon.
Yep, that he did. They both did.
Did Marty have any idea, Diane, did he have heart problems? Was that a sudden thing?
Oh yes. He had a serious heart attack in the fall of 1969, and he had open heart surgery in 1970, triple bypass surgery. It was one of the earlier ones. So his heart was in pretty bad shape at that time. And then he realized that that was his second heart attack, because he'd had a heart attack during the NASCAR race in 1968. He'd had these tremendous chest pains, and he'd had to get out of the car for a while and let somebody else drive. And then he got in and finished the race. And he found out later, when he had his heart attack and there was scar tissue on his heart, he realized that he had had a heart attack then. So this was his second one, and then they did that bypass surgery, and they told him at the time that it would probably last him like 13 years or so. So that was 1970, and then exactly 11 years later, January of 1981, then he had another heart attack and went in the hospital for about a week and had to be off the road a couple months or so. That was advertised as his second major heart attack, but he always talked about he'd had 3 heart attacks, and that's why, because he included the one that hadn't been diagnosed. And then his final heart attack came in December 82, and he was in the hospital for about 8 days, and his heart was just gone. They couldn't get him through that one, and so that's when he died. It was as the result of actually his 4th heart attack.
What are your favorite songs by Marty and Farron?
Well, for Marty, my favorite song is Tonight, Carmen, and then I like I'll Go On Alone, which was his first hit. And Farron, Step Aside, that came out in about 1971, that's always been one of my favorites. And then Your Old Used to Be, which he wrote with Hilda, and Johnny Paycheck did harmony on that one. And there's just lots more songs by both of them that I really like, but those are the ones that come right to the top.
Yes, I really love Foolish Pride.
Yeah, right, and that was one of his early ones.
How do you want them to be remembered? What do you hope these books will do for the people who really don't know them? How would you like them to be remembered? Any and all of those things. Anything you want to say?
Well, one of the things in Farron's book doesn't have anything to do with Farron personally. I hope people will read his book and find themselves or family members in there if they're having problems with depression or abuse, because it's so prevalent throughout Farron's book that they just tolerated him. And Hilda, who stayed married to him for 30 years, she kept hoping he would change. And you can just really see in there that the depression and the suicide threats that everybody thought he was joking, and also how all the DUIs he had. And I think if maybe if somebody had come down on him in the 1960s instead of waiting until the 1990s to throw him in jail for DUI instead of being buddies with the judges and getting off, that maybe that would have made a difference. So those are the things I'd like people to notice. But for the two singers themselves, I would like people to go out and get their music and listen to them, because they both had such great timeless voices, and they both had a variety of music, types of music. So even though you didn't like one particular style I'm sure they could find songs where they would enjoy their styles because they were just such good singers. And other than that, it's preserving the history and the music and the legacy. I don't know that there's any one thing in particular that I think each man should be remembered for.
Well, Diane, I think you've done a marvelous job in keeping them alive and introducing them to people who may not be familiar with them. I don't think Marty and Farron will ever disappear. And for anyone who reads either of these books, I know we will be enriched and a lot more sensitive about their lives and our ability to help others. And I think you've done them and us a marvelous service. And of course, we'll always have a legacy of their wonderful music.
There is one thing I would like to add about
sure.
the band members. In both books, I made a point of mentioning every one of their band members, because band members usually get ignored in stories,
yeah.
and even when you see on TV, you might see their hands, but you don't see all the musicians. They don't get shown like they're not important. But with both Marty and Farron, their bands played significant roles in their careers, and I tried to bring that out, and it really brings out how tough it used to be traveling to all these different shows when they were all crammed in the back of a car and just driving miles and miles on these bad roads. So it was a tough life. So that's another thing I tried to show in those books, is just what it used to be like, the life of a traveling musician back in the 50s and 60s.
It certainly was. And would you like to leave some contact information or tell people about how they can get the newsletter?
Oh, okay. Well, sure. I have a website, DianeDiekman.com. My name is spelled DianeDiekman.com. And then I also have an email address. It's Diane@DianeDiekman.com. And to actually get the books, go into any bookstore pretty much around the world and ask for it and order it, because they do have worldwide distribution for both of those books.
Well, Diane, I'd like to thank you for being here, and I want to thank all of the rest of you for being here tonight. And you can always write to me, Bonnie@AccessibleWorld.org. I'd like to thank you all for being here and would like to invite you to come back next time when we get together for another edition of the show I love, Books and Beyond. Good night.
Bonnie Bloss is the first place winner in the nonfiction category of the 2012 National Federation of the Blind Writers Division Contest. Her creative nonfiction essay is a memoir entitled The Art of Dying.
As much as I'm given, I want to leave a lot of happy women. I'm thinking pretty thoughts of me.
This has been Books and Beyond. On behalf of Bonnie and the Books and Beyond staff, thank you for listening. If you would like to communicate with Bonnie, write to Bonnie@AccessibleWorld.org. That's Bonnie, B-O-N-N-I-E, at AccessibleWorld, AccessibleWorld.org. We invite you to join us next week for another edition of Books and Beyond. I'm Curtis Delzer.
Be first, I might as well face it.
I want to find them, fool them, leave them, and let them do the same to me.
First class equipment is something a man's got to have. You might even call me a 20th century drifter.
I want to live fast, love hard, die young, and leave a beautiful memory.
32 weekends, I load up the car.